Hi, welcome back to Section. So today we're going to be talking about connecting to the internet, pretty much recovering or reviewing some material from 2 weeks ago, I think it was. So hopefully it'll be fresh in your minds for the exam this, like in a week. So yay! Cool, so here's our agenda. We're going to have an overview in pictures of the internet, some jargon, more talk about IP addresses, some more acronyms that I'll explain, or hopefully you guys are familiar with. I wanted to touch on redundancy, because it seems like a big part of the internet, and some extra fun with proxies and some other stories about my childhood that, let's not tell anyone else, okay? Anyway, moving on, the internet, an overview. How does this work? Well, you have your computer, which, you know, you can also call a client, because I guess you're like a client asking for stuff from the server. So a server is pretty much like a machine that serves up data. So it could be, you know, just the machine part of your computer, or it could be some specialized piece of machinery sitting on some racks. I'll show you some pictures of these later. But let's say you have a computer and there's a server sitting out there somewhere. So the general idea is your computer sends a request to the server, and then the server sends a response. Yay! Kind of oversimplified. So a more possibly accurate picture would be, you know, say your server lives in Cali and we're in Boston. So there are multiple like routers all over the place, more than shown here. But when your computer sends the request, say hello world, it sort of jumps or hops, I guess is the word, from router to router until it hits the server. And then the server likewise responds, and its response hops from router to router back to your computer. Yay! And there's even more detail where, you know, you have your modem. Not sure if you guys really need to know this because we didn't touch on it too much in lecture yet, maybe. But this pretty much acts as, it sort of translates digital data into analog, which, you know, like electrical signals and stuff like that. And the digital data would come from, you know, your computer, zeros and ones, things like that. So you can sort of think of it as your computer sends out the request, it goes to the modem, and then it sort of translates that into a form that the routers understand. And the same thing happens, it hops through the US or wherever you're trying to go, or I guess wherever your data is trying to go, and likewise the server responds. Yay! And then there's an even more complex picture where there's like networks everywhere. Like say, you know, at home you might have more than just one computer. You might have like a network of computers. And as Dan said in lecture earlier, you know, there's like a home router, which isn't quite like all these other routers. But I'll go more in detail later. So yeah, that's a sort of complex-ish, I guess, image of how the internet works. So let's talk a bit about the jargon. We have the client, which is the machine used to like view and interpret data. So things that look like this, you know, go into a computer lab or your machines at home, or I guess his laptop right here, that would be a client. And then a server, here's like a really close-up picture of a whole bunch of machines. You can see that they name their machines. There's Matra, Jeter, Dieter, not quite sure. But you know, here's a whole bunch of servers or machines sitting in racks in some data center, probably, with a whole bunch of information waiting to, you know, provide some services or serve up some sort of web pages or data. So, you know, they're sort of similar. They're both machines. And I guess if you wanted to, you can turn your, like, laptop or your PC into a server if you configure it correctly with, you know, the right software and all. So our next word is router. So router in the most general sense, or in a more general sense, is pretty much a device that transfers data across networks. So as you saw with Dan's trace route, his request sort of hopped from, say, Harvard to, I think at some point it got to, like, Seattle, and then it hopped to, like, Japan. So that's what the router, I guess it looks like that. And you can see them mounted on walls sometimes around here, I think. And then we have the modem. which I'm not sure if you really need to know, but this is what my modem used to look like back home. Two wire, it's big and clunky. We got it when I was in high school or something like that, so, you know, kind of old and outdated. But as I said before, a modem just translates digital data into analog signal for outbound, and it also translates analog back into digital for your computer to understand. Yay! Questions on terms? Okay, so moving on. So you have all these machines on the internet. How do they talk to each other? How do they know what to send where? And like, how come I don't get Bill Gates's emails or something like that? So to direct data, you need addresses, right? Sort of like in real life, you want to send a letter to your friend, you should know his or her address. Otherwise, I'm not quite sure how you would know, get the letter there unless you see them in real life. So for the internet, this is the equivalent of postal mail, I guess, addresses would be IP addresses. So as you've already seen, they're of the form, you know, well, here I'm writing, instead of the numbers, I'm putting letters, so W, X, Y, Z, where each letter is an octet, a number from 0 to 255. It's an octet because the computer, like the machinery, interprets it in binary. So each of these is 8 bits. So that's why it's called an octet. Because when I first saw it, I was like, what? That doesn't, what? It's like a single letter, what? So knowing this, how many possible IP addresses can we have again? Or if you know the math or how to get there? Guesses? Well, I think if you were to do the math, you'd do something like this. You have 4 letters, each of them is an octet of bits. So 4 times 8, you have 32 bits. How much can you represent with 32 bits? 4.2 billion, yay, that's a lot, right? Well, apparently not quite, as you've heard from lecture and possibly me last time. We're kind of running out of IP addresses. But more on that later. So here's an example of an IP address. This was my address when I was sitting at home typing, and I was like, oh, I'm gonna go check out my IP address just to put on this slide. So it looks something like that. Each of those numbers is between 0 and 255, because they're 8 bits. Yay, IP addresses, what's yours look like? Well, I guess you're not on computers right now, so I guess I should ask you later. Cool, so what, no animation? Oh, that's so sad. Okay, well, I guess you can imagine that it's animating, but so there's the general form again, W, X, Y, Z. That's for IP version 4, which is what we're on right now, I guess, with each of those letters representing octets. We've heard in lecture that the first octet stands more or less for class, which are pretty much just chunks of IP addresses for different entities, like different companies. Like MIT has their own class. Class A is what Dan called it. I didn't put class A here because I'll show you in a little bit there's more than just class A. So that's in generally, you know, the octet for class. And then subnet, it's not always the first 2 octets. It might be like the first 3, but I'll go into that in more detail on the next slide as to why that happens or how you can tell. But generally, you can just say on the left, you know, is the subnet, pretty much the network or the subnetwork part of the IP address. And the rest of it, you know, maybe it's just Y and Z, or maybe it's just Z, is the host identifier, so for that individual machine. Okay, so detail, more IP, maybe more detail than you want to know, but if you're, you know, interested. So, as I mentioned before, as this connection to binary, the machine sees those 4 numbers as, you know, zeros and ones, and then, as I said, the first octet correlates with classes. There's other classes as well as the A class. So over here, I've sort of written things in binary. So that's why you have 8 like letters and or numbers. And for class A, which is like the large size network, i.e. like MIT, or don't quite remember what else was on that graph, but MIT has their own class A, what? So those are represented with a 0, like to the leftmost of the very first octet. And then there are other classes like B, which is for like medium-sized networks. They, you know, have a, they begin with a 1 and a 0. And then C classes are for small to like medium or middle size, I guess if you want to call them that. And that's what they start with, 1, 1, 0, and then the rest of that octet. Yay. Cool. Random information that's sort of cool. Okay, so let's talk about this subnet mask thing. What the heck is that? Because when I looked at this, I was like, what the heck is that? Well, it confused me, so I'm going to tell you what it is. It can't stand alone by itself, even though it looks like, looks something sort of like this. It looks like it could be maybe an IP address, but it can't stand alone by itself. It needs to accompany the IP address. And what it does is you can use it, or I guess your router, your home router, uses it to figure out the network and then the host. Like sort of, maybe my example will explain better. So say you had that mask, which in binary looks like this because machines, you know, work in binary. And then say you had an IP address of that, which I'm not going to put in binary because it would be painful for me, but you guys should know how to, you know, translate binary to decimal. Might be on the test, maybe. But say you had that IP address, and then you sort of, like if you use this thing called binary AND, you can sort of think about it as producing a 1 only if, like if you're in binary, producing a 1 only if there are 2 ones. So you probably don't need to know that. But just know that you can use the mask and the IP address to sort of separate the network, i.e. What other adjacent, you know, machines next to yours, on the same network, like what numbers they have, and as well as like the individual machine. So here, using that example with that mask and that IP address, you'd have, you know, your network would be the 14 or 140.247.149.0 network, and then the host would just be the 203 at the end. So that might be a bit more information than, you know, you need to know or want to know. I don't know. I think it's interesting because I was like, what the heck is this mask thing and why do we have it? Well, it helps, you know, your router figure out, you know, what's on the network. Like if other machines have this beginning right here, they'll know that, oh, you know, it's on the same network. I don't need to like go to the internet. I don't need to send the stuff off to the internet or something like that. Yay! And then Dan talked about private IP addresses, you know, which cannot be directly referenced by others. Which is cool because you could have like tons of private IP addresses and just like one public IP address and you wouldn't really be adding to this problem of, you know, we're running out of IP addresses. So just know that, you know, they're there. They're helpful, they're cool. They're used in the NAT Dan was talking about, which I'll probably cover next week or during the review session. Yay. So yeah, so some examples that Dan gave were as private IP addresses are those who start with like 10 dot or, you know, 192.168. blah, 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 blah. So that's just a few examples that he gave in lecture. So let's talk about the domain name system. You have all these IP addresses. How do you know, you know, what URL they map to or what domains they map to? How do you know that, I don't know, 140 point whatever is harvard.edu? Well, you have your domain name system, which acts sort of like a phone book that I guess you can say sort of catalogs or has a list of sort of maps IP addresses to domain names, things that we can more readily read, you know, in words, not like a group of 4 numbers. And it's not necessarily a one-to-one relation. One IP address doesn't necessarily mean just one domain name. Like we saw with Dan's traceroute, CNN.com had like 5 IP addresses, I think it was. And then, yeah. Yay! And then that also possibly raises the question of, okay, so I need to figure out these IP addresses, what they map to. I have to go look at this phone book thing, this DNS thing. How do I do that? Well, lucky for us, it's automatic, using this other acronym, Dynamic Host Configuration Protocol. So as the P denotes, it's a protocol. So it's a method or a set of rules to, you know, get your IP addresses plus a few other things you need to connect to the internet. What are these things? Well, okay, that's what I just said. DHCP, yes, allows your machine to sort of talk to the internet or get on the internet, I guess. So how does it do this? Say you have your computer again, you're getting on the internet. Now I want to connect to the internet. I want to connect to the internets. Well, I didn't put the S, but oh well. And then you have this protocol, DHCP, and then it's sort of helps you do that by providing, you know, an IP address. So in lecture, Dan sort of personalized the computer as like saying, I want an IP address, and then DHCP, you know, gives that IP address. Not only that, it also has the DNS serverless for domain names, so it can, you know, map IP addresses to, I guess, URLs, if you want to call them that. And also tells you where is the closest router for you to, like, connect to the internet, which, you know, is useful, right? So you don't try to connect somewhere really far and not make it, which I guess with the machinery built in, your computer wouldn't try to do that in the first place. And it also gives you the subnet mask, which helps your router or your machines figure out what's on the same network or what's like close to you. Cool, so that's DHCP for you, providing you all the things you more or less need, like the basics to connect to the internet. Yay! Questions on this? Grateful that this thing exists and we don't have to go and memorize pseudo-random numbers? I am! Okay. Cool. So I want to mention redundancy, because I think it's an important topic, and Dan seemed to talk about it several times, so possibly he thinks it's important as well. So, what is this? Or what do I mean by redundancy? What I mean is there are multiple copies of most everything on the internets. And I guess offline too, if you make backups of your, you know, data and stuff like that. So this pretty much means that, well, this relates to how there are bunches of data centers in different locations all over the place. And in each of those data centers are many servers, many of those rectangular boxes, possibly with the names that you saw in an earlier slide, serving sort of the same data to different people, maybe to the same person who comes and goes at different times. But why do they do this? Well, one answer would be in case some of those servers go down. Like, say, if you only had one server, let's say I turn my laptop into a server and it serves out something really, really cool. And then everyone comes and gets it. And then my computer crashes, and now no one can get it. See, wouldn't that be sad? Then, no, you know, then it's, you can't get it anymore. But if I had two machines and one machine went down, then, you know, the other one could keep on serving the public, I guess, whatever it is that's so cool. So that's sort of the thinking of having many servers serving the same. Can you guys think of other reasons why you might want a lot of duplicates of everything? Do you guys make duplicates of your data for any reason? Okay, well, you should probably back up some of your data if you haven't already. I have like several, yeah, it's shameful. Anyway. Well, another reason would be to spread out load traffic. Like I said, if I had one computer and everybody in the world tried to connect to it, you know, that might just cause it to crash. Versus if I had two computers and like half of the people connect to one and half connects to the other, you know, there's less, I guess, less hardship or strain on my computers, and maybe they won't crash as often or as quickly. And then other reasons, possibly my favorite, for you'll see why in a little bit, but lower latency. So say I had my one server machine in California, because that's where I live, and say you're all the way over here in Boston, you're like, oh, I want to connect to Rosa's server, but it's really, really far away. So it's going to take a really, in terms of computer time, a really long time for me to, you know, send a request and get something back, right? So if my computer was closer to you, or if the server was closer to you, it would, you know, lower that latency, have less time to communicate. It's sort of the same reason why Google has their data centers like all over the place and not just in, you know, California or on the West Coast, because it would make things, you know, slightly in our terms, slower for, you know, people farther away like the East Coast or, I don't know, maybe in Japan or something like that. But yeah, lower latency is good. So here's a real life example that I'm pretty proud of, but hopefully, you know, you guys will be amused, if nothing else. So this is a screen from one of my games, and if you'll look here where I have highlighted in red, there's something called ping, which, to my understanding, sort of documents or tells you or gives you an idea of how much latency you have between you and the server. So here, if you like, if you're savvy with the game stuff, you'll know what my gamer tag is. You'll see that I have a ping of 32. So I'm not quite sure what the unit is, but that's definitely lower than someone with a ping of, say, 131 down there, error code 502. Right here, error code. He or she has a ping of 131. What? That's high. And someone over here has 147. Oh, no. Well, just so you know, Onks over here is one of my friends, and I think he's in Europe, and I usually connect to, like, U.S. servers, so that, you know, might be why his ping is so high. So a ping, to my understanding, is that when my computer sends off, you know, some sort of, like, request, say, hey, I want to get this packet of data for this part of the screen or something like that, and then their server comes back to me, you know, presenting that data. So it's the time that it takes for that to happen. So I'm not quite sure what the scale is, but you can sort of see it relative from person to person. So yay, low ping is good. Less latency is better. Well, it's the same thing, so low latency is good. And just to show you guys, just to make a point, here's one of the groups I'm in, and they host, let me zoom in, plus, they host different sort of servers. These sort of look like IP addresses. Well, I mean, I guess they do, plus this added, it's probably a port or something like that. But they host servers for players to connect to and game with other people who connect to the same servers. And you'll notice that they have servers on the East Coast as well as the West Coast. Some in Europe, United Kingdom, and they have some other servers for other things. So could you tell me why they might want to have different servers sprinkled, I guess, on the East Coast and on the West Coast, as opposed to just, like, one place? Why would you want to keep, you know, a bunch of your machines at opposite ends of the country? Do you guys have an idea? Maybe? Oh, wait, what's that? Yes, it's sort of like why Google has their data centers sprinkled throughout, you know, the world. Because, we'll say I'm on the East Coast right now. If I tried to connect to, say, a West Coast server, I would be able to. It's just that my gameplay might be diminished because it would be slower compared to, you know, if I connected to an East Coast server, just because of that physical distance and, you know, how our transfers are limited by, like, the speed of light. So tying this, like, the reasons back, it's sort of like how you would, well, I would hope that you have backups of your data, right? If you just had it on your computer, what if your hard drive crashed and then, like, you can't recover any of it and you don't have a backup? What are you going to do? Well, I guess it's gone in some sort of sense, unless you go to a data recovery center. But if you had backups, you could just, you know, use your backups. And if you, like me, go to school in one place and you live elsewhere, it'd be kind of, well, I guess I don't really do that. So what this is leading up to is I actually have, like, backups of my data back home, and I have, like, an external hard drive with the same data here because I don't want to, you know, have to ask my brother or whatever to go access that data and then send it to me. But yeah, backups are good. Redundancy is a good thing. Even though it takes up space and stuff like that. It is good. Yay, here's the fun part. At least I think this is the fun part. Or I think all parts are fun, but we're going kind of fast. So, hiding out. Maybe I should change that, but let's think about this. You know how Dan showed you all the things that is associated with your IP address? You could go to that website, whatismyip.com, I think it was, and it would sort of show you, you know, what service provider you had or where you were, like on this map, or you know, which, like where you were from and stuff like that, right? So isn't that kind of scary? They know that I'm connecting from Cambridge, from Harvard, oh noes. It could be scary. But what if, say, we had sort of a middle person that we could, you know, route our stuff to him or her, or it, I guess, would be better. And then that middle person would then, you know, go off and send it to wherever we were requesting things from. Then maybe it wouldn't be so easy as to, you know, where you were coming from or what, you know, where your machine is. So one way to do this, aside from the VPNs that Dan talked about earlier in lecture today, is web proxies, or are web proxies, I guess. And they're pretty much done through a web page. They usually look something like this, you know, a lot of ads and stuff, but they have this little text box here where you can input a URL. So let's go to that whatismyipaddress.com here with the proxy, and let's also go there without the proxy. Let's see if they're different. Go, internet, go. So here's without the proxy, it says, I'm at Harvard. Whoa. Well, that was weird. Okay, so here without the proxy, it says, I'm at Harvard. I'm in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Now, with the proxy, it says, I am in New Jersey. Am I in New Jersey? Possibly not, but the proxy server that I'm connecting to is probably in New Jersey, and then it's probably sending that information to whatismyipaddress.com here, I guess, through the proxy. And so it's displaying not my information, but the information of my proxy. So yay, they don't, you know, first off, they don't know who I am. Kind of. They think I'm from New Jersey, but they know I'm on a network sharing device. Oh no, what did I click? So that's one way you can sort of hide your IP's information from others. So as you saw, that was through a web page. Anyone with internet can go there and, you know, type in youtube.com or myspace.com was the big one at my school, because the school had sort of blocked that URL. But then if you had a proxy, you can go through that and get in. Not advocating that you guys should do anything like that. So if you use these web proxies, as I may or may not have done, you'll notice that, you know, it's pretty slow because there's this like extra middle person that you have to like send all your stuff to, and that person has to like, or machine, I guess, not really a person, sends, you know, that stuff onto wherever you want it to go, and a whole bunch of people may be using the same proxy, so that kind of, you know, taxes their server, makes things slow. There's also that latency because there's that one extra connection point, that one extra node, router, server that you have to go through. So when I was not doing this stuff, I wasn't very happy with the slowness, right? It would take like, I don't know, minutes for a page to load, and I was really sad. So I found out there were programs that did something like this, and you didn't have to go through another web page. And do I have a next bullet? So yeah, programs through a program. So what are some of these, you might ask? Well, I took the liberty of, no, where'd they go? Of going back to my old habits. There is, my favorite is John Doe. If we can get this searching. Yay, there we go. And then I have this browser just for it. So you guys can do this at home if you wanted to, I guess. Maybe. Not sure why you would want to. Okay, let's not look at that. Okay, waiting for it to start. There's also another program called Tor, which stands for the Onion Router. As router, you can sort of guess that it takes your data, routes it to somewhere else, and sort of acts as that middleman I was talking about before. So here's Tor connecting, and I guess John Doe is also connecting, so now I'll have three different IP addresses, or three quote-unquote different IP addresses. So if we'll wait for this to load. Oh, cool. Tor is up already. Yes, let's go. Oh, no. Okay, it looks like John Doe is also up as well. Anonymity on. Let's see if we go to whatismyipaddress.com. Waiting. You can see how slow it is because I have to go through that other middle person. Okay, here. Cool. It doesn't think I'm using a proxy. Yes. Awesome. Apparently, I'm in France right now, quote unquote. Yay. Here we go. We're using John Doe. So, cool. It doesn't think I'm in this country. That's nice, right? If you got an IP ban on you, you could like use this to do stuff. And here we go. And here's the Onion router. Let's check our IP here and see where it thinks we're coming from, or where our proxy is located. Waiting. As you can tell, it's pretty slow because it has to send information to that extra spot instead of going more or less directly, quote unquote. Okay, ha! It thinks I'm in California. Wow. So I've been in France, Cali, Boston in the last, I don't know, minute or so. Interesting. So yeah, this could be useful, right? Maybe if you want to be anonymous, as John Doe claims, you can be. Yay. But of course, since you're sending data, or since I'm sending data wirelessly, let me get back to the PowerPoint here. The things Dan talked about today in lecture, you know, having a sniffer or something, looking at the data that's getting passed through the air, John Doe wouldn't really protect you against that because it doesn't encrypt anything. So possibly an even better method of, you know, not showing your real IP unless, well, I'll get into that in a little bit. But an even better method would be VPN. So say, well, like Dan said, it offers remote access to a network. Say you have a VPN, Harvard's VPN, you know, installed and on your laptop, and you're in California or Germany or something like that. You could totally use that and make it seem as if you were on Harvard's network still, and all your data sent from your machine to Harvard's VPN. Like machine would be encrypted, so other people wouldn't be able to like sniff it and poke around and steal your data until it, you know, got to Harvard's VPN. Then if you have some friends on campus who were malicious, I guess they could try. But I guess this doesn't. This sort of lets you access sort of like a network away from the network, if you want to think about it like that. And it's. Well, it's encrypted, so it's good for you, as opposed to web proxies or programs. But, yay! Are you guys all going to go out and try this now? Or you can just try that link. You don't have to install anything. But it's slow, which, you know, I'm not a fan of slowness, but, yay? Okay, stairs, I see. Well, that's all I have for today. So, I guess, yeah, no questions? Happy studying? Maybe? No? Okay, well, good luck!